soon someone from this city. Secondly, I'm very pleased to be here in Fort Lee. I didn't know much about the city until I came. I hope that we will be able to baptize the city to Heliopolis, because I've seen here so many historians from the area, so it's only a suggestion. Now, to start, I would like to say that any discourse on the Shoah should be, for the sake of normative clarity, state that Shoah is an ultimate evil. This should be seen as self-explanatory and as a truism. The traumatic event of mechanized and systematic extermination of almost one-third of the Jewish people even casts its shadow over any other achievement human progress may produce. In addition, the Shoah has created a normative crisis of value identified with Western civilization. And finally, it has considerably shaken mankind's belief in the existence of God. I remember in the early 90s, in an internal briefing in our ministry, to newly appointed ambassadors, a senior colleague telling us his view on the Shoah. According to him, one should keep the memory of the Shoah as an intimate private memory and not expose the sufferings and traumata to the public stage. Thus, the memory will remain genuine and void of any banality, instrumentalization, and or commercialization. His remarks made a tremendous impression on us, but they ran counter to our own experience of how to establish and maintain a culture of memory. According to my understanding, the raison d'etre of the State of Israel is to establish a safe haven for the Jewish people, which has been dispersed and persecuted in the diaspora. As a consequence of the Shoah, an additional notion emerged that this kind of calamity would never be allowed to happen again. This statement should by no means lead us to undervalue the achievements of the Zionist movement and its endeavors to build a Jewish state much earlier. In this case, I am with Ben Susan. Israel was not founded because of the Shoah, but an earlier founding might have prevented the Shoah. To achieve the ideal of safe haven means not only to be resilient in our ability to defend ourselves. We should bear in mind the violent nature of our region, which has obvious difficulties in accepting us. As a result, it seems that we are doomed for the time being to live under a constant state of justified paranoia. The New York Times made a point in its headline from August 12th, 2009, asking, and I quote, "Is it too quiet for the Israelis? Apprehension growing of what trouble enemies have up their sleeves." End of quotation. It seems that Israelis do not allow themselves the luxury of conceiving daily life devoid of threats. The other side of this coin is fostering the heroic posture of being Israeli as opposed to the defenseless slaughter of Jews without a state of their own during the extermination. No doubt, the creation of collective memory regarding this unique traumatic event is a requisite. As time passes, by the survivor's generation dies out, and the fact may fade away. Yam Vashem preserves under 30 million pages of information and keeps a library of under 20,000 books in order to ensure a fact-oriented approach towards the Shoah for future generations to come. Suppressing unwanted memories accelerates forgetfulness victims and collective shame and or guilt on behalf of the perpetrator created a taboo around this event. For the perpetrator, Shoah denial was shaped as a tool for overcoming shame and guilt, or as a vehicle to express continuously racist anti-Semitism. This silence was slowly broken in the late 50s and during the 60s. The Eichmann trial that was mentioned before led also to finding a new articulation of Shoah among the same generation of both victims and perpetrators alike. I would like to add here that the immense success in the reception of the drama The Substitute by Hall, which was initially breakthrough in Germany but later all over the world, plays by, to my opinion, a certain moral relief among those generation of perpetrators, because to their minds, how can we be guilty alone, or if at all, if even the moral authority of the Pope could not do anything or did not do anything? I think this is the reason why the substitute was so much accepted as truth, because it was a moral, it caused a moral relief among many in Europe. The second generation was the one that promoted the culture of memory of the Shoah. What was the strategy to keep collective? What was the strategy to keep collective memory, and what were the consequences? It is believed that memory is maintained through repetition. A child repeats his home address until he succeeds to learn the address by heart. Likewise, personal memories were disseminated through vast publishing enterprises. Motifs of Shoah became an essential part of post-war literature and visual media of mass communications. Repetition was regarded as a vehicle to keep the memory alive. The obvious success of shaping and maintaining the culture of memory had, however, adverse effects. Repetition also created room for the interpretation of the Shoah as a subjective truth. As decades elapsed since the unique event took place, the problem of relevance emerged, especially when the indescribable events had to be explained to younger generations. In order to keep the memory relevant, some believe that the corresponding representation should be staged for the sake of explanation. As time elapsed, nothing was self-evident anymore. One saw the Shoah described in comics or in the manner of a soap opera. Perhaps it was inescapable, but that the path towards banalization and commercialization was opened. Moreover, since political correctness prescribed the term Holocaust as the ultimate evil, the temptation to label other events as the Holocaust became politically rewarding. Holocausts in Biafra, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Burundi or in Darfur marked the headlines of the media, each in its turn, and also helped to foster the attention they deserved. The price, however, was a blurring of the uniqueness of the Shoah and its memory. The term Holocaust became politically inflated, a vehicle to transport political and human grievances of any kind. As you might notice, I am trying to avoid using this inflated term, as there are indeed those who do not know today what the accurate meaning is of the word Holocaust. Originally, Holocaust was a Greek term in the Bible translation of the Septuaginta for the Hebrew term Ola. The Ola is a sacrifice which is entirely burnt to the sinner on the altar. This religious term was not applied to human beings, according to the Torah. human sacrifices of the pagan cult of Baal are termed Olot in plural, and these, of course, are harshly criticized by the prophet. Uvalu et bamot ha-Baal, nisrof et neem ba'esh, Olot la-Baal, asher lo tziviti velo dibarti, velo alta alidi. The Catholic Dua Reims version, and I quote this version because it is closer to Septuaginta than others, from 1750 edition, presents the following translation. And they have built the high places of Baalim to burn their children with fire for the Holocaust to Baalim, which I did not command nor speak of, neither did it once come into my mind. The very use of the Greek term Holocaust is not an indicator of whether the term referred to a pagan or a Jewish rite of sacrifice. Xenophon uses the term Holocaust in his historical account Anabasis around 365 before our era, which is much earlier than the Greek translation of the Bible. He meant, of course, the Greek pagan rite of sacrifice. Xenophon's text was read by virtually all students of classical Greek throughout European history. The educated class in both France and England were often as familiar with classical texts as they were with the Bible. They would thus frequently associate sacrifice and holocaust, meaning a whole burnt offering, with pagan practices. The 30 lines entry of Holocaust in the Diderot and d'Alembert Encyclopedie, published in 1765, makes no references whatsoever to Jews or Jewish practice, only to sacrifices and honoring infernal gods. In 1929, Winston Churchill described the Turkish atrocities on Armenians as an administrative holocaust. On the other hand, an appetite for a general clearance sale in New York in 1932 appeared claiming that Oriental and domestic rights are all included in this great holocaust of rights, of price. 1 year later, the New York Times reported from Berlin that German students will organize ceremonial holocausts of such books that do not reflect their perceptions of German spirit. The first application of the term Holocaust to the Nazi extermination of Jews appeared in November 1942, then in the editorial of Jewish Frontier in America, and it stated, I quote, "In our calculation of a Holocaust that has overtaken the Jews, we speak of victims not of war, but of massacre. The annals of mankind hold no similar record of organized murder." This is replying to whatever could be known already during the Holocaust to the public. And yet, even after 1945, the term Holocaust never became a synonym wholly devoted for describing the extermination of Jews. Until the early 60s, it was used mainly in the context of nuclear catastrophe. Indeed, those years were marked by a certain spell of taboo when it came to the massive Nazi extermination of Jews. It was François Mauriac, a good Catholic, who for Elie Wiesel's book Night in 1958 adopted the religious meaning of the term Holocaust used by Jeremiah as an abnominal sin of pagan human sacrifice. Mauriac, a practicing Catholic, introduced Night with the following remark. I quote, "For him," meaning Wiesel, "God is dead. The God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has vanished forevermore. In the smoke of a human holocaust exacted by race, the most voracious of all idols." In 1939, Wiesel himself adopted the interpretation of a Holocaust survivor as an exemplary experience of a sacrifice. Bach's interpretation might hopefully open a path towards formulating a Catholic doctrine in which Holocaust denial should be considered a sin against God. Pope Benedict XVI is repeating this statement several times after the Williamson affair. What is lacking still is a doctrinal binding statement of the Catholic Church. It is interesting to note that when the Israeli law establishing Yad Vashem was proclaimed in 1953, its English title was Remembered Authority of the Disaster and Heroism. The term Shoah was translated as disaster. The main publication of Yad Vashem in the late 50s was called Yad Vashem Studies on the European Jewish Catastrophe and Resistance. There, the Hebrew term Shoah was translated as catastrophe, which is, along with disaster, a rather accurate translation of its biblical meaning. The term Holocaust for the Jewish extermination was used seldom, and even in the 60s, always with a suffix Jewish or other qualifiers. The overwhelming use of the term Holocaust was still in its nuclear context, marking the peak of the Cold War. In the 70s, the use of Holocaust in American publications for expressing Jewish extermination increased. After all, in 1978, the US-American TV feature Holocaust was shown for months in many stations through the Western world. But the term never became synonymous and could never be identified with the Jewish extermination only. There are many reasons why Shoah became the preferred term to use if one means the unique event of mechanized and systematic murder in which about one-third of the Jewish people was exterminated. Firstly, it presented an alternative to the use of the somewhat blurred meanings of the term Holocaust. The uniqueness is better maintained with the term Shoah. Secondly, by using the term Shoah, one is able to show respect to the victims and solidarity with their offspring and to the manner in which they themselves express their memory in their own Hebrew language. Most likely, we owe this change of terms to the filmmaker Claude Lanzmann, who titled his 9-hour documentary Shoah, which he produced in 1985. His widely acclaimed documentary made this Hebrew term internationally known and contributed accordingly to its growing acceptance. This acceptance is shared also by the present Pope Benedict XVI, who in the 70s commemoration of Kristallnacht and many times after referred to the Shoah and not to the Holocaust. Just as when a child continuously whistles in the dark in order to overcome his anxiety, Jews ever since the second generation of Holocaust survivors have developed paranoid attitudes to avoid forgetfulness. This notion is specified through repetition, or in other words, through ritualized memory. The Jewish nation as a victimized collective was haunted by the lack of a clear-cut English expression through which the culture of memory could be maintained. To this very day, to share its unique victimizations with atrocities done to other nations seems to amount to a betrayal of a legacy which was transferred by the survivors to all future Jewish generations. One should not underestimate the Jewish ability to keep memory of distant historical events. I am reminded mainly to the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem in the years 70 to our era, not to speak about the Exodus from Egypt, the biblical memory. The obligation to keep memories of traumatic events is well phrased in Psalms 137, 5-6, as follows. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand to cling. Let my tongue speak to the roof of my mouth, if I don't think about you above all else, meaning the temple. should not be surprised if the memory of the Shoah becomes ritualized sometimes in the distant future. That's an alternative of forgetting is definitely.